Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of The Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled From Plato to Postmodernism, Understanding the Essence of Literature and the Role of the Author. The lecturer is Professor Louis Marcos. Professor Marcos specializes in British Romantic poetry, literary theory, and the classics. He received his B.A. in English and History from Colgate University and earned his master's degree and Ph.D. in English from the University of Michigan. He is a member of Phi Beta Kappa and has gone on to win teaching awards at both the University of Michigan and at Houston Baptist University, where he has taught since 1991. Each of Dr. Marcos' lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 1, Thinking Theoretically.
Hello, my name is Louis Marcos, and I'm an associate professor of English at Houston Baptist University in Houston, Texas. And I will be your guide on an exciting, thought-provoking, whirlwind tour of literary theory. In this introductory lecture, we shall take our first tentative steps towards learning to think about literature in a critical, theoretical way. The lecture will be divided into a brief overview of the nature and importance of literary theory, a summary of the approach that will be taken throughout this series, and a close look at a well-known fourfold system for defining and arranging various theoretical stances that was developed by M.H. Abrams. But first, let us ask, what is literary theory and why should we study it? First of all, the phrase literary theory is synonymous with literary criticism and critical theory. I'll use those names interchangeably. Literary theory, literary criticism, and critical theory. What is literary theory? It marks a 2.5 millennia attempt on the part of artists and critics alike to define the exact nature, status, and social function of the arts. But I think the best way to describe literary theory to you is not in a one-sentence definition, but through a series of questions. Literary theory is all about questions and addressing those questions. Let's look at 5 questions that theory asks. The first one, what is the ultimate source of poetry? Where does poetry come from? Does it come from on high? Are we inspired by God or Plato's forms? Do they tell us what to write? Or maybe it's nature and the spirit of nature that inspires our poetry. Or then again, maybe what poetry is a form of self-expression. So maybe the source of poetry is not an external God, but an internal consciousness or an internal self-expression. We'll look at that question throughout this series. What is the source of poetry? A second question. Does poetry as a fiction draw us closer to or farther away from truth? What is poetry? There are a lot of people out there that will say poetry is all lies. Why even bother reading it? And it's funny, real religious people will say that, but then sometimes real technical people will say that. It's all lies. It doesn't teach us anything. It leads us astray. Let's learn something that's practical. On the other hand, some people say, no, not only is it not lies, actually, poetry is a higher kind of truth. Think about the prophetic books of the Bible. All of those are written in poetry, as are all the wisdom books, like the book of Job or the Proverbs. So that's a debate within literary theory. Fiction or higher kind of truth? That's another question. Let's look at number 3. Is the poet an artisan working a craft or a divinely inspired genius? In other words, which is more important in the production of poetry? Genius? In other words, do you have to be born a poet, made a poet? Or is it art? Is it craft? Is it skill? Is it something that we can learn? Now, really, all theorists are going to say it's a little bit of each. But some are going to say more genius, and some are going to say more art. That is, again, a perennial question in literary theory. Number four, does poetry and the poet serve a useful function in society? Now, there's a big question. As our society becomes more and more scientific and technological, people say, poetry, that's a waste of time. There's no practical value, no pragmatic value. And throughout this series, I will often make an analogy between poetry and literature and the humanities. Because a lot of the things people say about the, quote, uselessness of poetry, they also say that about the humanities. And being an English professor, I feel that very strongly. And did it when I was an English major as well. And that's a question. So is poetry just frivolous and has no value to society? Or, on the other hand, is poetry actually very useful? Is the poet somehow a public figure that can add to his society and to his state? Finally, a fifth question. Is a poem a self-enclosed artifact whose meaning is eternal and transcendent, or a product of various social forces? Now, we won't get to that question until really later in this series when we get to modernism and postmodernism. But the debate there is, the traditional view of poetry is that poetry captures truths that are eternal. Like we say of Shakespeare, he was not for an age, but for all time. The truth of his poetry is ever relevant, ever true. Other people, though, say, no, poetry is not eternal. Poetry and the arts in general are just a product of society. Just like politics or economics or any other product of the society, poetry is just another product. And that means it's not eternal. It's temporal. Again, that's a struggle. Now, these questions I've gone over, I want to emphasize that they are not merely academic questions. This is not just ivory tower stuff that has no meaning outside the academy. I'm going to try to show you throughout this series that we're talking about important things here, things that have relevance. And I believe that literary theory, how we define poetry and the poet, has bearing on at least three things. It has bearing on the way we view ourselves and our culture. Again, if poetry is eternal, somehow that makes us eternal. I mean, if there are ideas that are always relevant, then perhaps inside of us there are ideas that are always relevant. What about culture and society? Much of our culture is stored in our arts, our belles lettres, as they call them. And so the way we define poetry actually is going to be linked to the way we define ourselves, who we are, what our purpose is, what the purpose of culture and civilization is. Now, that's a big claim, but I hope to substantiate it as we go along. Another thing that literary theory has bearing on: our appreciation and estimation of such things as beauty and truth. Many of you have heard that famous line from Keats, beauty is truth, truth beauty. Well, I want to show you that the way we define beauty is linked to the way we define truth. Because if we look at beauty as some kind of eternal standard, beauty with a capital B, we're probably going to look at truth that way, and vice versa. So they are related. Finally, another thing that literary theory has a bearing on is our ability to find meaning and purpose in the midst of tragedy. Now, unless we ourselves die young, we are going to have to go through the grieving process. We are going to have to go through tragedy and despair. And how are we going to deal with that? Well, I want you to know that long before any of us dealt with it, the poets have been dealing with these issues forever. And that includes religious poetry, but it also includes secular poetry. Poetry helps us to understand why things happen to us and whether or not we have purpose. Poets got us going. Now, kind of a way to sum up the first part of this lecture, I hope by the end of this series you will realize that the presuppositions we bring to our reading of poetry are closely allied to our own, often unstated presuppositions about God, man, and the universe. The way you view those things, God, man, and the universe, will have direct bearing on the way you view art and the status or role or nature of art. And again, I hope to convince you of that as we go along. And by the way, Because of this, you're going to hear a lot of philosophy and theology in this lecture, because they go together. When you do critical theory, you can't help but bring in philosophy and theology, because again, our view of God, man, and the universe is viewed to our view of art. All right, now I want to talk about the approach that I'm going to be taking in this series. This is a long 24-lecture series, give you a little bit of a diagram of what's to come. First of all, and you may have guessed this already, I will be basically confining my survey of theory to critical appraisals of poetry. Now, poetry includes poetic drama, both Sophocles, ancient Greece, and Shakespeare. I will mention every so often prose and other things, but my focus, is going to be poetry. So a lot of times I'll just say poetry and the poet, although most of what I say will have reference to literature in general. And I will make some references to art and opera and things like that. Now, why stick to poetry? This is not something really unique to me. This is a traditional approach to theory to focus on poetry. Indeed, until fairly recently, literary criticism was basically synonymous with the criticism of poetry. What we call narratology, in other words, theory that looks at novels and prose, that's really a 20th century phenomenon. Until recently, literary theory pretty much meant poetry. Now, part of the reason for that is that traditionally, poetry has been privileged above prose and has been considered a higher, more spiritual form of writing. And again, you'll remember a moment ago I mentioned that the prophetic and wisdom literature of the Bible is written in poetry. And most people see poetry as closer to truth, as more profound and meaningful. Now, maybe that's a prejudice. That is a prejudice that many are attacking. But traditionally, until the last even 50 years, poetry has been privileged. It's considered a higher genre of literature, the highest, really. And by the way, poetry also includes epic. So, you know, there are many things that are poetry. But poetry is privileged. Finally, why I am looking at poetry particularly, the greatest defenses of literature have really been defenses of poetry. Much of critical theory is literally a defense or an apology for poetry and poets. Believe me, it's not just in our technological age that we've had to defend poetry and the humanities. We've had to defend that all the way back, okay? So those of you that are interested in the humanities, I'm going to give you some fodder to answer your scientific, technological friends that tease you for your interests. And especially if there are young people whose parents tell them that if they major in English, they'll be homeless people in the street. So anyway, we're going to look particularly at two very great defenses of poetry. One is Sir Philip Sidney's Apology for Poetry, and the other is Percy Shelley's Defense of Poetry. But again, there's always an aspect of defense or apology in literary theory. All right, how am I going to organize this series? Rather than organize it around themes, that's one way to do it, or schools of theory, or genres, those are all ways I can do it, but I'm not. I'm going to take a chronological, great man, major work approach. And this is very traditional, canonical, fairly typical of the teaching company. In other words, we're going to start with Plato, the beginning, and go right on to postmodernism for the last 30 or 40 years. And it's going to be what we call a milestone approach. I'm going to look at, if you want to call it, the great books of literary theory, or most of them are essays, the great essays of literary theory. Traditional approach, and I'm totally unapologetic about that. These are our milestones. This is the basis of much of Western civilization, so we're going to go through that. I will mention, some of the attacks on that, but that's going to be the focus. Now, nearly all of the individual lectures in this series will center around a close analysis of one or two seminal essays by one or two key theorists. Most of the lectures will focus on one essay by one theorist, and I'm going to dig into it, give you a close, detailed analysis. So this is not going to be a sort of generic overview. You're not only going to learn literary theory, you're going to get to know the milestones of literary theory. Now, sometimes I'll look at two, and some of them will be survey-oriented, but most of them will focus on one essay, and you'll know it well. Now, although each of these individual lectures is going to be grouped together, let me explain. There's 24 lectures, and I've broken it into 6 4-lecture units, so 4-4-4, 4-4-4. And I think that will help us to get some chronological and thematic sense. However, even though the lectures are going to be inscribed within one of 6 units, still, I am going to allow each lecture, that is to say, each essay, to speak for itself. In other words, I'm not going to try to force or shoehorn each lecture into a specific unit or, you know, a chronological era. I'm going to give you that focus, but again, I want to treat each work with its own integrity. Now, I would strongly suggest that all students purchase the book Critical Theory Since Plato. If you look in my bibliography, it will explain. I believe this collection is the best and most comprehensive textbook available. It's excellent. It's very well worth buying. And in fact, what I have done is I've basically chosen essays that are anthologized in it. Now, most of the ones are, you know, everybody chooses Aristotle and Plato, but I've made it so that if you buy that one book, you will basically have all the raw material you need. So I would strongly encourage you to buy that book. In fact, if you want to get the most out of this series, this is what you want to do. Listen to my lecture, say, on Aristotle's Poetics, then read Aristotle's Poetics in Critical Theory Since Plato, and then if you would like, listen to the lecture again. That, you're really going to get the most meat and the most benefit out of this series. Finally, there's another reason why I've chosen Critical Theory Since Plato. It adopts the same basic milestone chronological approach that I use. So, again, if you buy that, that's really the only companion you need. I've given you a huge bibliography, but that will help. All right. As I present each major work in each lecture, I will attempt to convey at least three things. First of all, I'm going to try to convey to you the writer's vision of the nature and status of both the poet and the poem. Basically, every theorist, every essay has something to say about poetry and something to say about the poet, or more generally, the art and the artist. And we're going to look at the nature, what is a poet, what is a poem, but also the status. Now, the word status means what is its role or function, is it worthwhile? Everything is linked in that word status. And so we're going to have something to say about poet and poem in almost every lecture. Another thing that we will look for as we go through the essays is some of the unique contributions that the work has made to the history of literary theory and to how readers interpret the poems they read. So I will be making links between the lectures, so do remember them because I'll refer back. You'll have your outline, so if you want to go back. And I'll show you, you know, why they're influential. Why are these milestones? How did they influence people? And also try to give you an idea of how this has changed the way we read poetry. And so again, you're really going to get to know these these essays quite fully. Finally, as we go through each essay, we will look at the meanings, sometimes esoteric, of the key critical terms used. There's lots of terminology in literary theory. Some of it's jargon, some of it isn't, but there's a lot of terminology, and that's true in philosophy and theology, isn't it? I'm going to do my best to explicate and to define for you these key terms as we go along. And a lot of the terms will repeat themselves, so hopefully this course will build on itself, and you'll maybe even be able to figure out what I'm going to say before I say it. That's what I hope will happen as we get farther along in this course. Finally, in the second part of this lecture, some of the unique aspects of this series. First of all, one slight difference. It will be slightly less concerned with historical and biographical detail than other series in the teaching company, I mean. The focus will remain on the works themselves. I'll say a little bit where a date's necessary or some historical background, I'll give it to you. But my focus is going to be on the works themselves. Now, as in most teaching company products, you'll have a timeline and full biographical details. But I want to warn you that I'm not, in this series, going to rattle off dates for you. I'm not going to say Aristotle, da-da-da-da-da, because it's going to get boring. That's all in your outline. If you're watching this in video, some of it will be on the screen. But again, I'm not going to rattle off dates. They're in your outline. I'm going to focus on the works and the people. And again, because, you know, as a traditionalist, I don't believe that poets are products of their age. And so I'm going to try to present them as for all time. Yes, Shakespeare's a Renaissance figure, but he's also for all time. So that's a little different maybe than you're used to. Also, and you may have guessed this by now, I'm going to be treating these essays that we look at as their own genre. In other words, literary theory is its own genre. And so I will be treating the essays almost as if they're poems. I will be treating them as a work that's worth studying, not only for its ideas, but for the way those ideas are presented. So literary theory is its own genre worthy of study. I mean, you can, as I did in graduate school, you can study literary theory as a genre. Also, a little bit different, my bibliography will contain less recent scholarship than most series. Actually, there is quite a bit. But unfortunately, with literary theory, as you get closer and closer to our age, the works get more and more esoteric, more and more jargon, more and more impossible to understand. In fact, a lot of PhDs can't understand a lot of literary theory. I'm going to try to help you in my later lectures. But what I've tried to do, I've given you recent scholarship, but I've given you what I think is the most accessible. And of course, there's a little, you know, it's an annotated bibliography. But again, I would encourage you to read my annotated bibliography and choose from there. Now, nevertheless, despite what I've said here, my lectures will be informed by recent academic concerns. As we go through, I'll say things like, now, today, in postmodern days, this is attacked. So it will be there. Also, one of the places where I really deal with recent academic squabbles, if you will, is in my glossary. And if there is one thing special about my series, about my outline, that sets it apart, I have given you a huge glossary. I spent almost as long in the glossary as the lectures themselves. Because, again, critical theory is full of terminology, and I would encourage you to spend a lot of time in the glossary. It is actually cross-referenced, because you can't just take a word by itself. So I would really encourage you to refer to the glossary. You might want to just sit there and read it. There are people that like to read the encyclopedia. Read the glossary. I think you'll get a lot from it. Finally, very important, do not be intimidated by strange concepts and jargon. Everything will be explained to you. Those of you that are listening to me, if you do not know how to program your VCR, raise your hand. Okay, now, based on the dynamics or statistics, I would guess about half of you raised your hand. Now, I myself am totally mechanically illiterate, but I can program my VCR. Now, why is that? It's not that I'm smarter than, say, my parents who can't do it, but because I grew up with VCRs. In the same way, when I went to graduate school, I graduated in 1991 from the University of Michigan, everything was theory. So if I understand this and you don't, it's not because I'm smarter, it's because I grew up with theory. So it's going to be a little bit different, but get used to it. Okay, those of you that are trying to figure out computers from your children and grandchildren, think of it that way. Think of it as a challenge. So don't be intimidated, and don't let the ivory tower people intimidate you. It's not that hard once you break through the jargon. Finally, in the last part of this lecture, what I want to do to get you thinking theoretically is to talk about a way of looking at theories and grouping them. The great literary theorist M.H. Abrams, who's still teaching at Cornell, he's in his 80s, still working, in a book called The Mirror and the Lamp, he set forth a fourfold way of looking at literary theory. In other words, he takes all the approaches and breaks them into four categories that he calls mimetic theories, pragmatic theories, expressive theories, and objective theories. And that's what I want to explain now to get you thinking in theoretical terms. And remember this, because these terms will come up again and again. Now let me begin by giving you a little diagram for your mind. Imagine, if you will, a diagram, and at the center of the diagram is the poem, or the literary work of art. Then there are three branches coming out from the poem. Three branches, kind of like a triangle. The first branch takes the poem and attaches it to the universe. The second branch attaches it to the audience. And the third branch attaches it to the poet. Now keep that in mind as I go through. I'll keep reminding you. All right. First of all, mimetic theories. These are the oldest kind of theories. And they're interested in the first branch. In other words, they're interested in the relationship between the poem and the universe. Now, why are they called mimetic theories? The word mimesis in Greek means imitation. And mimetic theories, who are interested, again, in the relationship between the poem and the universe, they explore the nature of imitation, or mimesis, and they tend to view the poem as a mirror of external realities, whether natural or supernatural. In other words, what poetry is an imitation of something outside. Now, for some mimetic people are religious, and so they believe it's imitating God or the divine. Some are more naturalistic, and so it's imitating nature. But in any sense, the idea is that poetry imitates things external to it. And that's what poetry is. That's the oldest kind of theory. And we'll explore that in our first unit, this lecture through lecture four. Now, all mimetic theorists agree that the best poems come closest to approximating and even capturing the higher reality it seeks to imitate. In other words, for a mimetic theorist, the best poem is the one that imitates the universe the most closely. However, mimetic theorists disagree as to whether the whole imitative process brings us closer to reality or farther away from reality. As you'll see in the next three lectures, Plato believes mimesis takes us away from reality, whereas Aristotle thinks it takes us closer. So they all believe in mimesis, but some think it's better or some think it's worse. We'll go through this. Finally, mimetic theorists are concerned with the ultimate meaning and essence of poetry. In other words, what is a poem is a question that they like to ask. What is its essence? What is its nature? Those are mimetic theories, and they are the oldest kind of theories. All right, pragmatic theories are the second branch. They're interested in the relationship between the poem and the audience. Pragmatic, practical, they're interested in the impact on the audience. Now, pragmatic theorists assess the social didactic functions of art. And all pragmatic theorists say that the function of art is to teach and to please. Now notice, the focus there is not what is the poem, but what impact does it have on the audience? Is the audience taught? Is the audience pleased? If they are, the poem is good. It served its didactic or teaching function. Now, another thing about pragmatic theorists, they establish aesthetic rules for judging two things. They want to judge the skill or art of the poet. How well the poet does what he's doing and how well he impacts the audience. So they're interested in things like skill and art. And they're also interested in issues of taste and judgment. They're interested in the audience, so they're interested in proper audience taste, a refined kind of taste. And I know all people that listen to Teaching Company lectures are a refined audience. So, now, finally, they explore the impact that poetry has on its readers or listeners. And some of them will even get psychological. What kind of impact? The word catharsis that some of you know, we'll look at that later. What kind of impact does it have on the audience? Those are pragmatic theories, and we'll look at those in Unit 2 and Unit 3. Expressive theories look at the third branch, the relationship between the poem and the poet. That is what expressive theorists are interested in. How is the poem related to the poet? Now, according to expressive theories, poetry is the reflection of internal rather than external realities. If you're a mimetic theorist, poetry imitates things outside. But if you're expressive, you believe that poetry is self-expression. And most people today have an expressive, which is really a romantic view of poetry, that it's self-expression. A poem encapsulates the inner workings of a poet's psyche. According to expressive theories, poetry has a personal rather than a social function. They're more interested in the individual poet than the impact on society. And also they believe that poetry has a prophetic rather than didactic teaching. In other words, pragmatic people want to teach didactic. Now, expressive people, I guess they want to teach too, but in the manner of prophecy. Think of the difference between the book of Proverbs in the Bible and the book of Revelation. Well, they're both teaching, I guess, but in a radically different way. So expressive theories, and those are mostly romantic, are interested in the prophetic nature, the idea that the poet is a sort of seer that speaks something to us out of his psyche. Finally, for expressive theories, they believe that the question, what is a poet, is pretty much synonymous with what is a poem. They're so linked together that to ask one question is to ask the other. And we will look at those in Unit 3, and particularly in Unit 4. Finally, where is my fourth one going to come from? I ran out of branches, didn't I? Ah, there's one more. What about the relationship between the poem and itself? Objective theorists want to lop off the three branches and just look at the poem as itself. In other words, objective theorists focus on the internal relationships of the poem itself. Let's not worry about universe or audience or poet. Let's look at the poem as an object. Now, according to objective theorists, and that's what we're going to look at in Unit 5, that's an early 20th century view. According to objective theorists, a poem is a self-contained, self-referential artifact that can and should be studied apart from the universe, the audience, and the poet. It is self-contained. It's its own little world. Many of you are familiar with the word microcosm, Greek for little world. Objective theorists believe that a poem is a microcosm, its own little world. Forget about the universe, because the poem is a universe. And this poetic universe or microcosm runs in accordance with its own observable laws. And so again, objective theorists are not going to worry about what to them is peripheral. They're going to dig into the poem and they're going to figure out the internal structure of it. So again, remember those four orientations. They will come up again and again. Mimetic theories, interested in the poem and the universe. Pragmatic theories, the poem and the audience. Expressive theories, the poem and the poet. And objective theories, the poem in itself. Again, I invite you into the world of literary theory. I'm going to tell you many times to gird up your loins. In the old days when men wore skirts, you'd kind of lift it up and go running. I'm going to tell you sometimes to put on your seat belts, because many of the lectures I'm going to be moving pretty quickly. I teach in Texas, but I'm actually a Yankee from New Jersey, so I can speak much faster than my Texas colleagues right now. So sometimes we'll move fast, sometimes we'll move slow. But stay with me, and again, do not be intimidated. I will explain everything.